I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. North and South Korea are now talking to each other through a telephone hotline, which could signify a thaw between the two countries. On Monday, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un proposed starting negotiations and even taking part in the Winter Olympics that start in February in Pyeongchang. South Korea's new President Moon has called for dialogue with the North and welcomed Kim's offer. Kim also threatened that he has a nuclear button on his desk if the U.S. threatens his country. President Trump responded by tweeting last night, "Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I, too, have a nuclear button, but it is a much bigger and more powerful one than his and my button works." Nikki Haley, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, gave North Korea this warning.
The civilized world must remain united and vigilant against the rogue state's development of a nuclear arsenal. We will never accept a nuclear North Korea.
Joining us is Trudy Rubin. She writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Just got back from a trip to Israel, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights. Trudy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here, Marty.
Also with us and joining us from the studios, NPR studios in Washington, D.C., is Rosa Brooks. She's a professor of law at Georgetown University, associate dean of graduate programs, and she's got a book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, takes from the Pentagon. Rosa Brooks, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here, Marty. Thanks.
Let me begin with you, Rosa, if I could. Are we looking at a possible war with North Korea?
I would have said 2 years ago the odds of an actual military conflict with North Korea were very, very low, you know, one in 50 or so. I think in the last year they've gone up to about 3 in 10. I still think it's unlikely, not least because the wiser heads, if you will, in the U.S. government, including at the Pentagon, are, I think, making pretty enormous efforts to persuade the president that an open military conflict would be disastrous, not only for North Korea, but for U.S. allies, South Korea, and U.S. troops. So I still think it's not likely that it will happen. But the bellicose rhetoric we've seen from the president suggests that you can't rule it out.
But you're saying without these wiser heads, we could have been headed for war?
Well, President Trump seems unable to resist the Twitter provocations. And obviously, the my button is bigger than your button is only the latest in a long line of tweets that seem designed to provoke. I think that the North Korean regime is perfectly rational. They're an appalling regime. They violate their citizens' human rights. They're a terrible repressive regime, but they do not want to cease to exist. And there's no particular evidence, despite their rhetoric, that they are determined to start some sort of conflict. And in fact, as we've seen just in the last couple of days, they seem to be sending some olive branches out, not to the United States, certainly, but to South Korea.
How do you see this rhetorical war, if I can put it that way, Trudy, or even conflict between these two leaders?
Well, I think that the key question is whether the Trump administration, if there is a coherent policy, and if it's headed or directed by someone other than Trump, is looking for a preemptive war or not? And the second big question is, are they willing to entertain the idea of talks, dialogue with North Korea without a prerequisite that North Korea accept the idea it's going to denuclearize? You had Nikki Haley at the United Nations in the last couple of days saying we won't take any of the talks seriously if they don't do something to ban nuclear weapons in North Korea. And we need to do it now. Maybe, again, that's just careless rhetoric, like the president's. Secretary of State Tillerson at the Atlantic Council recently said you can't expect denuclearization at the beginning. So you have these
kind of a mixed message coming out.
Very mixed messages. As you know, Tillerson has been trying to get some kind of backdoor dialogue going so that the two sides, North Korea and the United States, at least understand each other's bottom line. So we simply don't know whether this administration will entertain the idea of talks without preconditions. And the initiative by Kim and the response by the South Korean president are an interesting test of that, whether the U.S. will support such talks. And President Moon has to be very careful because the North Koreans always demand to be paid for things that are basically a concession to them. So you have to, the South Koreans have to be careful that if they're going to talk, say, about the Olympics at Panmunjom in the demilitarized zone, that they're not giving concessions just so North Korea can have the gift of taking part in the South Korea Olympics.
And very, very tricky negotiations there. Rosa, let me go back to you, though. Do you think, and this is not the first president that's tried to figure out how to deal with North Korea, does the world need to just learn to live with a North Korea with nuclear weapons?
You know, I'm not sure we're going to realistically have another choice, although I wish that were not the case. I mean, North Korea does have nuclear weapons. It's not will they get them, when will they get them. They've got them. That's obviously true of numerous other countries around the world. And what we have, I think, quite sensibly done in the case of Iran, although it's something that President Trump has been very upset about, is enter into an agreement that is designed to ensure that nuclear materials are used for peaceful purposes and so forth. I think that there is, in the longer run, there is a possibility of doing that with North Korea as well. But at the moment, you know, they are a nuclear weapon state. That doesn't necessarily mean that we should be quaking in our boots, despite the recent rash of headlines. You can always count on North Korea to be and to remain weird. Over the New Year's holiday, there were a display of ice sculptures of the Hwasong 15 missile, which the North Koreans claim can reach all the way to the United States. And people were proudly posing with their families in front of the ice sculpture of this missile.
Fascinating.
But despite all their boasts, you know, we can get you any time, et cetera, you know, I think that the assessment of experts on North Korea's nuclear capabilities, including U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, say, no, they don't really have the capability to actually strike the United States. They're making a lot of noise because they're scared. They're scared that if they don't seem willing to use the weapons that they have, that their regime has a very short life expectancy at this point.
Well, that raises the question whether they see them as offensive or defensive, whether they think it's to protect them from the United States and others that might do them ill, or whether they want to start a war with us or somebody else. Rosa, quickly, if you don't mind, then Trudy, I know, wants to respond as well.
You know, it's the big question. My own take on it is that they are primarily defensive. That if you are Kim Jong-un and you are a member of his regime, that you are very, very nervous for very, very good reasons. Your own people don't like you very much. Your hold on power is tenuous. Your economy stinks. And you know that absolutely everybody, including your so-called allies in the region, would be quite happy to see you go, that your nuclear weapons are what you cling to try to ensure your own longevity. But that using them is suicide. They know that. Using or showing signs that they are about to use them would be absolute suicide for North Korea.
How do you see that, Trudy? How do you see these weapons, what they mean to North Korea and especially to Kim?
Well, on the one hand, it's clear that they have learned the lesson of Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi, which is that nuclear protects, and if you give it away, you're vulnerable to regime change. So that's clear. On the other hand, in negotiations that took place in the past, including in 2005, the United States offered fully to recognize, to denuclearize the peninsula, meaning no U.S. nuclear weapons, and to accept North Korea as a separate country in return for halting their program, which was then much lesser and less developed. And they refused that. So it seems that there is no security guarantee. It isn't simply that they're afraid of regime change. It's that there is nothing that they will accept as protection, less than nuclearization. And so that raises the question. Trump has put himself, backed himself into a corner by insisting publicly over and over again that nothing but denuclearization will suffice. If that's the case, right, then it puts you in a position of going to war. I think the other thing that is a justifiable fear with the North Koreans is that even if you could envision that they would stop the program where it is and that you could contain it, is proliferation, because they have such a terrible track record of spreading weapons and weapons information that there is a real fear that, given their economic situation, they would be willing to sell know-how, if not fissile material.
Because they need the money. I mean, this is desperately poor
because
country.
They need the money. But I think the biggest question right now is whether the Trump administration would settle for anything less than denuclearization, and do they demand a commitment to that up front?
Do you see them backed into a corner, them meaning, I guess, the United States of America, Rosa? Do you see our being backed into the corner by saying we will not accept a nuclear North Korea?
Well, yes and no. On the one hand, rhetorically, President Trump does not seem to have left himself a whole lot of wiggle room. On the other hand, again, I guess two things here. We have seen in other situations that Trump has happily reversed position and not seemed particularly bothered by it. So what to a different person might be viewed as, well, I've now made this set of commitments, I can't change it, I think to Trump, I don't think he views the world that way. I think he's extremely expedient based on his own assessment of what's good for him. And if he deems it politically expedient for him, he will reverse course. He won't have any hesitation about reversing course. The other thing, I think this very much goes to our earlier discussion, I'm not sure that we have a U.S. policy towards North Korea. I think we have at least two different ones that are actually pushing in different directions. You know, we have Trump, who is raising the rhetorical temperature with these sort of constant tweets. But at the same time, we have, at a minimum, we have Secretary of Defense Mattis and Secretary of State Tillerson, who seem to be trying to do the exact opposite. We've seen Tillerson suggesting that the U.S. would be open to talks. We've seen Mattis saying, hey, look, no, the threat is not imminent. These missiles cannot reach us. And by the way, a conflict would be absolutely catastrophic. So we absolutely must find a diplomatic solution. You know, we will destroy them if they try to attack us, but we need to find a diplomatic solution. So we're really seeing two quite different U.S. foreign policies operating at once, which is, I think, pretty confusing for the rest of the world, needless to say. And, you know, on the cost of the conflict.
You know what, Rosa, hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. We're doing a foreign policy roundup focusing on North Korea. We'll be talking about Iran after this short break. Rosa Brooks, Trudy Rubin, our guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Rosa Brooks. She's professor of law at Georgetown University, associate dean of graduate programs. Trudy Rubin joins us as well, and she writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We have been spending some time talking about North Korea for all the obvious reasons, and you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Rosa, I had to interrupt you. Just finish your thought there, and I'll get Trudy back in on the conversation.
I was about to start on a really depressing thought, Marty.
Fair enough. We're all ears.
Well, you know, I think that we, as a nation, the United States of a nation, we've forgotten exactly how awful wars can be, because we have been in the privileged position for the last couple of decades of being able to fight wars that have been relatively low casualty for us. You know, when you look at the Afghanistan and Iraq conflicts combined, for instance, the number of deaths compared to Vietnam was very, very small. The number of deaths, U.S. deaths compared to the Korean War, much less World War II, were just minuscule. And that's partly because of advances in military medicine, but it's mainly because of the rather limited destructive capacities of our enemy, of our enemies in those circumstances. And I think it's important to remember that when we're talking about North Korea, again, it is a nuclear weapon state already, not in the future, but now, and it also has an enormous conventional army, that the potential costs of a conflict would not be measured in the thousands of casualties as they have been in Iraq and Afghanistan, but in the hundreds of thousands and possibly millions. Right. And when I say that, I mean not only North Koreans, but also our South Korean military allies, South Korean civilians who are within a stone's throw of the North Koreans, not just a missile launch, potentially allies in Japan and elsewhere, but also the many U.S. troops who are stationed in the region. And that is not a reason, needless to say, to let North Korea get away with blackmail indefinitely, but it is, I think, a reason to do our absolute utmost to avoid a military conflict, because I don't think that most Americans alive today realize quite how catastrophic it would be. It would be a return to the full-on types of conflicts and casualties that we are more familiar with from the original Korean War in the 1950s and from World War II and World War I.
And we know what that looks like, certainly. Let me just put something else on the table here, Trudy, because I do want to talk about Iran. There's much to talk about there. What do you make of the fact that it looks like North and South Korea are beginning to talk to each other? You were telling me during the break that you have been on the demilitarized zone, put your foot into North Korea along with other journalists. But how do you see, is this a thaw? Is it the North Korea playing South Korea? How do you see it?
It's a feint by the North, in which I presume there is an effort to decrease tension, which would make it harder and look more unpleasantly aggressive for President Trump to keep threatening. If you had a lead-up to the Olympics in which the two Koreas were speaking with each other and the North was preparing to send a team south, I don't see anything wrong with that in terms of ratcheting down tensions. I think the tricky wicket is that the North is making clear they're going to try to demand concessions in terms of the U.S. Transferring anti-missile technology, in terms of postponing or delaying indefinitely or canceling joint exercises. The North has a clear intention of presenting itself as wanting peaceful reunification and the United States as the aggressor. And I think that's a very careful line that the South Korean leadership has to walk to make clear that, yes, they're willing to talk about the Olympics, but they're not going to pay a price in terms of their own self-defense. Because time after time, when the North Koreans have gotten paid a price, then they never deliver on their end. And asking for strategic concessions in return for having the right to take part in the Olympics is just the kind of trick that the North Koreans will try.
But do you think the new president of South Korea, Moon, is he up to the task?
There are indications that the answer is yes. I mean, he is somebody who believes in dialogue. That's the tradition of his party. But I also think he's aware that he needs U.S. protection. He understands the Trump approach. And he's trying to walk that line because also there are a lot of South Koreans who are very wary of the North. The North has been very aggressive towards the South, and I think there's less pacifism than there was a couple of decades ago in the South.
I do want to talk about Iran, but Rose, anything you want to add to what Trudy just said there?
No, this is a wicked problem, as we say, right, that the North Koreans routinely make outrageous demands and say outrageous things, and they possess nuclear weapons and they make noises about a willingness to use them. And that clearly is something that most of the rest of the world considers unacceptable, not to speak of the internal dynamics of the extremely repressive regime. But at the same time, you know, it's a pretty effective threat.
Yeah.
Because, as I just said, the consequences of a military conflict are so catastrophic. You know, that unfortunately, I think that Trump's rhetoric notwithstanding, in many ways, the North Koreans do hold a lot of cards, and the U.S. in some ways does not. Because unless we are willing to accept the truly catastrophic consequences of a conflict, we have to find some way to deter and contain, and that often feels like being, you know, over a barrel.
Well, we have been talking about North Korea. Let's talk about Iran. For weeks now, or I should say for a week, there have been anti-government demonstrations in a growing number of Iranian cities by people frustrated over the state of the country's economy, over its political system. The unemployment rate for young adults is something like 40%. And as of this morning, it's estimated that 21 people have been killed, hundreds arrested in a crackdown by the government. Now, President Rouhani has called for calm, defended the rights of protesters. Iran's supreme leader blamed the enemies of Iran for the protests. And President Trump tweeted yesterday, "The people of Iran are finally acting against the brutal and corrupt Iranian regime. All of the money that President Obama so foolishly gave them went into terrorism and into their pockets. The people have little food, big inflation, and no human rights. The U.S. is watching." Nikki Haley, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, said this yesterday.
"The demonstrations are completely spontaneous. They are virtually in every city in Iran. This is the precise picture of a long oppressed people rising up against their dictators."
Trudy, is she right?
Not really. I think it's very clear that these demonstrations started for economic reasons. They started by young working class men who are in a particularly bad situation in Iran. The government there has been trying to rationalize the economy. They've been in deep economic trouble with sanctions and with depressed oil prices, and so social safety net has been eroded. Subsidies have been cut back, and unemployment is high, and young people have no hope. This is not something new. My first trip to Iran was in 1991, and people were talking about the fact that young Iranians couldn't move out of their parents' apartment because they couldn't afford apartments. When I'm talking to Iranians,
like the United States.
Yeah. When I'm talking to Iranians now, they say again that's one of the problems of young people. So it started with economics, and you see that people are fed up with both sides of the political divide because they're not delivering. That doesn't mean that Trump is popular. Mm-hmm. The visa ban on Iranians is very unpopular. I'm talking to people who are monitoring a video coming out of Iran. The sanctions are not popular. If President Trump pulls out of the Iran nuclear accord and restores sanctions, that could be a rallying cry for the government that could undermine demonstrations. So it's very complicated. It's not a simple uprising, and frankly, it's not likely to lead to a government overthrow because there's no leadership. It's disconnected.
Let me read something that was in the New York Times today. Rose, I'll read this to you, get your response. And apparently this budget was leaked. Iranians discovered that billions of dollars were going to hardline organizations, the military, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and religious foundations that enrich the clerical elite. At the same time, the budget proposed to end cash subsidies for millions of citizens, increase fuel prices, and privatize public schools. And it seems to me that, you know, anyone living under that would take to the streets. How do you see it, Rosa?
No, I think that's exactly right. And you know, as Trudy said, the Iranian public has plenty of economic grievances. And, you know, one of the precipitating factors for the current round of protests, you know, in terms of what's occurred in the last couple of years, was that in many ways, President Rouhani was promising Iranians that if he could get this nuclear deal with the United States, sanctions would be eased and all these economic benefits would start flowing to ordinary Iranians. That hasn't happened. And in fact, you know, this leaked budget suggests that it wasn't just bad luck that it was, you know, the fix was in all sorts of ways. There's terrible corruption inside of Iran. And people are really angry. They feel like they've been sold a bill of goods. You know, they were promised something and it didn't come to pass. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, in any country tends to fuel unhappiness. It's the old Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid, operating in Iran as well as the United States. I think that, you know, as Trudy said, President Trump and Nikki Haley are being a little overly optimistic by reading the protests as a more sweeping condemnation of Iran's form of hardline Islam and the government more generally. There were pieces of that among some of the protesters, but in many ways it's a, you know, more limited economic unhappiness. And I do think, you know, I mean, here, of course, the United States is right to speak on behalf of peaceful protesters and their aspirations for a decent standard of living, a non-corrupt economy, and human rights. But here, as with North Korea, my big worry is that the response from President Trump and others, and of course in the United States in this moment, everything happens on Twitter, risks actually making things worse for the protesters and provoking even more of a crackdown.
Well, and that was that not part of the calculation for President Obama? I think this was back in 2009, Trudy, and he got criticized for it, for being quiet. I mean, he had some early on support for protesters, but essentially decided best for the U.S. to stand on the sidelines. Clearly, President Trump sees this very differently. How do you see those two presidential responses?
Well, I think there's two pieces to this. First of all, verbal support for the peaceful right to demonstrate and against a violent crackdown, I think, is perfectly appropriate. And I think it would be good if the Europeans were doing the same, because I think that the Iranian regime will be looking, especially to the Europeans, more than to the United States, because they want to do trade. They've been hoping for investment. And I think that's one of the best hopes to avoid the kind of brutal, violent crackdown that we saw in 2009. So that kind of language, not calling for regime change, but supporting peaceful demonstrators and against brutal crackdown, fine. What is upcoming, if these demonstrations continue, is that the president, again, is going to have to either certify or decertify the nuclear accord and decide whether to issue a waiver that allows sanctions not to be reimposed.
Right.
I think there are going to be voices within the administration, including probably in the president's head, that say, okay, let's pull out of the accord. Let's reimpose sanctions and try to provoke regime change. I don't think regime change is in the cards here, but the idea being, if you hurt the Iranian economy more, then the people are going to rise up. Frankly, the people do not have the guns. The regime has the guns. And so I think this kind of approach would give the Iranian regime some bandwidth to say to the population, a lot of your troubles are on the heads of the United States president. So this is going to be a seminal moment if the demonstrations keep going and if there isn't a crackdown before then. The president has to make this decision, and one wonders, you know, which way he's going to go.
Sure, and what the effects would be. And Rosa, even looking back over decades of U.S. policy, when have sanctions ever led to the overthrow of a government by the people?
Well, I don't know if overthrow of the government by the people is the right metric, but I think that there have been times when sanctions have clearly had an impact. For instance, think of South Africa in the apartheid era. In that case, though, I think, and this is a big difference with Iran today, there was a very substantial popular movement. There was both a nonviolent popular movement and there was a military violent resistance as well against the government. And so sanctions were part of a broader picture. Sanctions alone, in the absence of robust internal dissent, I think it is very hard for them to make an immediate difference. But I also think, you know, here's the one little piece of good news. There's some really fascinating research that's been done by political scientists, Erica Chenoweth and Maria Steven, on the efficacy of nonviolent resistance against repressive regimes compared to the efficacy of violent forms of resistance. And what they found, somewhat surprisingly and counterintuitively, was that nonviolent protests and movements were twice as likely to lead to significant political change or regime change than violent resistance movements. And the fact that there is not yet that kind of mass resistance, nonviolent resistance in Iran, does not necessarily mean that it won't develop over time. And I, you know, going back to our earlier discussion, you know, I think that the most important thing that the United States can do, and other countries around the world, particularly the Europeans, is to really try to, in ways that don't provoke a backlash from the Iranian government against the protesters, to try to give strength and moral support, make sure that social media channels remain open so that protesters can communicate with one another in the outside world, and so on. Because I don't think Iran is a lost cause. You know, I think it is entirely possible that in 10 years or 20 or 30 years, we'll see a very different kind of Iran.
That's Rosa Brooks. She's professor of law at Georgetown University, associate dean of graduate programs, joining us along with Trudy Rubin, who writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We are talking about North Korea. We're talking about Iran. And after this break, we'll talk about some other countries, some other hot spots as well. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. What do you want the United States to do, if anything? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times.
Let us go!
That's the sound of anti-regime protests in the Iranian city of Ahvaz. Talking about what's happening in Iran with Trudy Rubin and Rosa Brooks. Let me just get Walter called us up, and he's waiting very patiently from West Philadelphia. Walter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I had a question about whether Iran and North Korea have formed more of an act of evil than we've been led to believe. I've heard reports that basically that the Iranians have traded their missile technology and their oil money to help develop the North Korean nuclear program, and basically letting the North Koreans do the work for them under the cover of, you know, our nuclear agreements with the United States. They don't have to work on a, you know, nuclear project. They're letting the North Koreans do all the work for them, and since they have the missile technology, they'll trade it with the only people they can trade with, which is North Korea.
Well, Walter, let me see what our guests have to say. Trudy, do you want to respond to his comments? Do you know, do you have any information that North Korea and Iran are working together on developing nuclear?
Well, North Korea sells where they can and consults where they can. Iran has very competent scientists and has developed, you know, gone far towards developing. But at the when their program was in a more initial phase, if I recall correctly, I mean, there are stories that they have had consultations with North Korea. I mean, it's a two-way street because both of them have very experienced and talented scientists. But the North Koreans have been way ahead in development. And, you know, I think there is information that there's been exchange. I can't remember the details, but
well,
there is.
Rosa, do you, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think another piece of the picture, particularly for Iran, Iran, as your listeners likely know, is one of the countries that is subject to the so-called travel ban. It's become very, very difficult to impossible for Iranians to live and work or study in the United States. My worry about that is that the more, you know, this, and this is the downside of sanctions as well, you know, that the more you isolate a nation, and not just the leadership, but the people,
the more you push them into the arms of other people, you're going to like even less. Mm. And, you know, that there are enormous advantages to the United States. You know, one of the things that President Obama was always very careful to do with regard to Iran was distinguish between the regime and the Iranian people. And Trump, President Trump, has been somewhat less careful to make that distinction in his rhetoric. He's been a little bit more all over the place, but making it clear that the United States as a nation is welcoming and will create opportunities for Iranian people to come here, to study here, to do businesses here. And obviously there are legitimate security concerns that we have to be alert to. But I think that we really cut off our nose to spite our face when we make it difficult for ordinary people from these nations to come here. And it just tends to push them into the arms of other bad actors.
But just to follow up there, so that if the president is supporting people protesting the Iranian government, if they wanted to come to the United States,
they can't come in.
Refugees, they would not be allowed because, as it stands now, they're on the travel ban list.
Correct. Correct.
Trudy, go ahead.
Just one point I want to make about the difference between North Korean nuclear program and Iran's. North Korea withdrew from the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, so there are no inspections of their nuclear facilities. Iran, under the JCPOA, the nuclear accord, is subject to very intrusive inspections, and although they are not perfect and military sites very difficult to get into, the fact is that the kind of inspections that are going on there are unprecedented. And if the president pulls the U.S. out of the accord, there will be no inspections. And that certainly would open the door to a lot more cooperation, if there is such, between the two.
Let me read a tweet from ATP. Trump urging of Iranians to rise up is like George Herbert Walker Bush, the first President Bush, urging Kurds to rise up against Saddam. Does he have a point there, Rosa?
Well, I think that there's a very real danger that the U.S., through the voice of President Trump, makes what protesters will read as promises that we can't or won't keep. That to the extent that we urge people to, you know, get out there in the streets and protest the regime, you know, that people in Iran may read that as an implied promise, and we'll take care of you, and if we have to, we will come in and change the regime. But, you know, historically, we haven't tended to keep that kind of promise. I don't think that we either would or could keep that promise in this case. I think that Trudy's suggestion earlier that it's possible that President Trump is trying to provoke a crackdown to give himself the excuse that he has really been looking very hard for to pull out of the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement with Iran. I think that that's a real possibility. He went along only very, very grudgingly. He was quite open about his dissatisfaction with the pleas from Secretary of Defense Mattis, Secretary of State Tillerson, not to pull the plug on the deal earlier. And he made it pretty clear that he was going to revisit that. So I don't think it's being too cynical to think that it's possible that he's perfectly willing to have the Iranian protesters used as pawns, and that if there's a, you know, it's heads he wins, tails they lose.
Yeah.
Insofar as, you know, if they protest and that leads to some sort of peaceful change, fantastic. But if it doesn't, and far, far, far more likely it leads to a brutal crackdown, he's happy that way too.
How do you see this? Where do you see this going, if it's possible to predict this, Trudy?
Well, I think it's very hard to predict. I mean, one thing I want to say about the previous point, I think Iranians are fully aware that the United States cannot be trusted. It's not simply, I mean, I was in Iraq in 1991 after Saddam cracked down on the South on Shiites after Bush said, rise up. It was brutal. And believe me, Iranians know what happened in the south of Iraq because hundreds of thousands of Iraqi Shiites fled to Iran, and many of them still live there. So it's no secret. But more than that, the United States just let the Kurds down in northern Iraq. The United States has been toying with abandoning the Syrian Kurds, who did most of the heavy lifting against ISIS in Syria. And the Iranians are aware of this. That's number one. Number two, Iranians are not demonstrating because the U.S. is encouraging them or because they expect U.S. ground troops. What's going to happen in Iran is not going to be determined by what we say. And if the regime cracks down, we are not going to be there to help. And they know that. So I think that the kinds of things that could be done that are productive are what I said before. The Europeans should be encouraged to speak out. Unfortunately, this is not an administration that tries to work together with allies. If this were George Herbert Walker Bush's administration, he would be talking with Merkel and Macron and urging them to speak out against any kind of forceful, brutal crackdown on the demonstrators, lest that make it absolutely impossible to get European investment in Iran. That's the kind of nudging you have to do, and that is not within the President Trump's mindset.
That's Trudy Rubin from the Philadelphia Inquirer, Rosa Brooks from Georgetown University joining us to talk about some of these foreign policy challenges. Of course, the most obvious, North Korea and Iran, and you can join us as our caller did at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Rosa, Susan Glasser had a really disturbing, I have to say, but also fascinating piece in Politico, Donald Trump's Year of Living Dangerously. She interviewed a number of people, many of them not on the record, but these are our world leaders. And some of the words that they used to describe President Trump were things like catastrophic. And these were diplomats, terrifying, incompetent, dangerous. Do you see the president that way?
I do see him that way. And in fact, to pick up on Trudy's comments, I think part of the meta story looking at both North Korea and Iran has to do with the rapid and catastrophic decline in U.S. leverage, even with our allies, that President Trump, from the time he was on the campaign trail, made it very clear that he had little but disdain for either for both traditional U.S. alliances, including NATO, and for multilateral treaty arrangements and deals. And his string of somewhat erratic and bellicose tweets directed, you know, every day there's a new one. This morning
several.
He's going after the Palestinians, several, threatening to cut off U.S. aid to Palestinians. You know, that what he has succeeded in doing was in a world in which the U.S. was already dealing with relative declining power for all kinds of reasons having to do with globalization, the rise of other states as powers, you know, that we were already struggling to figure out how to be effective as a leader in an increasingly multipolar world. What he has managed to do in a very short time is essentially burn up an enormous amount of goodwill, and in terms of the internal dynamics with staffing and budgeting for our own diplomatic corps, et cetera, essentially destroy our ability to do anything. We now find ourselves in a position with regard to both North Korea and Iran and many other situations around the world where, quite frankly, we have very little ability to control it. You know, we still have this illusion in the United States that we can control events. We never could to the extent that we imagined we can, but we have now put ourselves in a position by essentially dismantling our own diplomatic structures and alienating our own allies, and in which we essentially have almost no influence on anybody. The only thing we have left is a very big stick, or as President Trump would put it, a very big button.
A very big button, and apparently it's a briefcase, not a button. But we'll leave that aside. Let me read a tweet, and this was from this morning. But for all I know, there's been another tweet. And Trudy, I'll put this to you because you just came back from a trip to Israel, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights. The president tweeted, "It's not only Pakistan that we pay billions of dollars to for nothing, but also other countries. As an example, we pay Palestinians hundreds of millions of dollars a year and get no appreciation or respect. They don't even want to negotiate a long overdue peace treaty with Israel. We have taken Jerusalem, the toughest part of the negotiation, off the table, but Israel for that would have to pay more. But with the Palestinians no longer willing to talk peace, why should we make any of these massive future payments to them?" How do you understand what the president is saying?
When I saw that tweet, all I could think of was, in all the time that he has been dispensing his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his favorite lawyer, Mr. Greenblatt, to the Middle East, supposedly to concoct the perfect deal, did he ever get a briefing on what is going on the West Bank?
Does he understand Jerusalem? It's so shockingly
ignorant. It's not just Jerusalem. It's the money that is going to the Palestinian Authority. What does he think it's going for? Israel does not want to formally reoccupy the West Bank, even though they control everything about it. So the Palestinian Authority provides the services that keep the place going. That's where some of the money goes. And others of the monies go to training the Palestinian security forces. What do? They keep Hamas down on the West Bank. They substitute for having the Israeli army in there full bore. So what the president is talking about is pulling back money that would mean that the Israeli military would have to go back in full score and take over formally the West Bank again. And right now, we can claim it doesn't occupy. It does, but they would have to go back in officially. Such ignorance is almost beyond comprehension. If he got a briefing, it never got absorbed. Mm. And then taking Jerusalem off the table, there is no negotiation if you take Jerusalem off the table. That is why, I mean, the Russians were smarter. They said West Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, East Jerusalem is the capital of the Palestinian future state. It's more complicated. The old city is the hot button, and you have to figure out a regime. The Jewish state will never and should never give up control over its holy places, the Western Wall. But this has to be on the negotiating table. Otherwise, there is no negotiations, and he simply doesn't know anything about it.
Rosa, we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye. We talk about the Iranian nuclear deal. Is the peace deal, and of course that has eluded presidents for decades now, but is that dead if Jerusalem essentially is off the table?
Yeah, I think it's completely dead. I think that there is essentially zero likelihood of progress being made during President Donald Trump's administration.
So what happens next? And Trudy, you just put your hands in the air.
What's happened?
Maybe you did too, Rose. I just can't see you.
What happens next is the status quo, except the status quo keeps changing on the ground. What the Israeli government is looking towards, and what I think Greenblatt and Kushner were on the verge of proposing, is keeping the status quo and calling it a state without official boundaries. I mean, so you have on the West Bank, Israel controls 60% of the territory. 40% is, in theory, under the control of the Palestinians, but that 40% is divided within by settlement roads, so it's not really controlled. You could call it a state minus, 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 or autonomy plus, or autonomy minus, whatever you call
it.
It's
not a state.
It's the status quo, and settlements will keep being built. Doesn't mean there's an easy settlement. The Middle East is in disarray. You don't want a weak state, but at least you could hold the status quo, the real status quo, and leave things open for negotiations. The Trump administration is ruling out future negotiations as well as present.
I hate to end on that note, but this is the world we live in. Trudy Rubin, thank you for joining us on Radio Times. And Rosa Brooks, thank you for joining us as well.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us.